Before I really get started, I need to warn you, I'm using a homemade remote. It's almost certainly going to break. So when that happens, please bear with me. There's a backup just tucked around the corner. Today, I'm going to talk about pockets and Doctor Who and time. And I want to start by telling you all a theory that I've got. It's kind of a theory that I worry a little bit will get me kicked out of a pub one day when I start talking about it a bit too passionately. But I'm sharing it with you because I think that you might be my people. Some of the talks earlier certainly indicated that I'm probably in a good room for it. So here's my big theory. I think we're all time travellers. I think we're all learning how to travel in time. I think we're all learning how to cope with multiple continuities and multiple networks. And I think we're all learning that there are big dangers when we attempt to cross one of the streams into another one. The kind of problems that you face when you realise, shit, I've shared that with the wrong circle. But we haven't worked out what kind of time travellers we're going to be yet. And I think that's really evident by the devices that we carry around us, with us, and the things that we have in our pockets. To my mind, there are maybe two kinds of time traveller. This is one. It's a Dalek. It's the kind of time traveller that absolutely understands its purpose and its mission in a place without having to really explore very much. And then this is the other. This is the Doctor, who has to really play with his surroundings, has to interact with them to understand his context and his role. The main difference between the two is not just in the technology and the attitude, it's the way in which the Doctor plays with the world. That and the fact that that's a big fucking robot. The little objects that the Doctor carries around with him humanises his journey and helps him find new ways of understanding the place that he's with and helps the people that the story he's telling his journey to, it makes a lot more sense for them. So I want to start with an example. I want to start with quite a pertinent example with time travel. I want to start with the big system called time and how we've changed that. Back in 1840, standardised time was this complete revolution. The railways introduced it in order to sync up local time zones because there were localities like London and Brighton that seemed to differ by as much as 15 minutes. Midday meant a different thing to those two places. And that's not just because of the sun being in the sky at a different point. It's because local authorities just figured time meant different things in different places. And that stops an awful lot of things happening very easily. It especially stops trains running on time, which is why the railways just went, we've got to sort this out. So they synced up time. They standardised it. They made sure that all of the routes ran to the same thread, the same network. And they made sure that all of the clocks in those localities were synced to it. It became law. It was the means by which one town could suddenly start planning with a really specific degree of accuracy how another town was operating. It also kind of made hijacking trains a little bit easier. That wasn't too much of a problem in the grand scheme of things. But when synchronized time really came into its own was when it stepped out of the communities and into the pocket, into the pockets, because there'd been an early adopter community just waiting for it to happen. And those were the people who were carrying pocket watches. Now, pocket watches themselves are about 500 years old. These weird boxy contraptions that wouldn't sit like mine does today, literally in my pocket, but in a box that was kind of strapped to the side of you, or in an enormous medallion kind of object, a little bit like Flavor Flav, who is a boss. But as the mechanisms refined, the objects themselves began to shrink, and they reached this kind of optimal point with the lever escapement, which came into being just a few short years before synchronized time. So, time shrank. All of these early adopters, ready and waiting for it to happen, had objects that they could currently sync it to. And because the cheap mechanisms like the lever escapement had suddenly become easier and easier to produce, that just boomed through society, filtered through it incredibly quickly, became incredibly cheap, incredibly easy. So everyone in a society was suddenly networked to one another in the way that the towns were. They were able to plan for one another's routines. They were able to know how long it was until dinner. And they'd be able to guess just about when and where their friends were going to be in time. Which, if you're living in the mid-1800s, is really fucking weird. To suddenly think that you're in not exactly two places at once, but that you've got a connection to many different kinds of places, was a revelation. And it's coming at the same kind of time as the railway is expanding. Radio is just around the corner. They've got telegraph wires booming up and down the country. All of this stuff, all of this connectivity is going on. And the pocket watch is the first instance of people coping with it. It's the first one of those networks of railway and radio and the rest of it that people can shrink and make manageable and intimate and pocketable. The pocket watch is a great example of how we react to big networks and big new systems. And there are an awful lot of contemporary equivalents that I do want to touch on today. Mike Kuniavsky, middle of last year, maybe earlier last year, talked a lot about service avatars. And he probably wasn't thinking of the pocket watch when he was talking about the service avatar, but it works as a perfect example of exactly what the service avatar is. Now, a service avatar is something through which a person sees a service. In the pocket watch's case, it's an object through which you see time and all of the big network that it represents. Last.fm or Spotify or Netflix all have different kinds of service avatar on different objects. So Last.fm on an Xbox feels incredibly different to Last.fm on an iPhone, as it should, because it's optimized to do the best thing that it can for those kinds of service. He came up with this phrase because he sees in the very near future a boom of pocket-scale devices, little objects through which we access one, maybe two, maybe three networks at a push. So it's incredibly important to think about them as objects that you design for very differently. But when an object exists on that pocketable, intimate scale, it also takes on an additional quality. It's not just time that I see through that device. What I see through that pocket watch, the one here, is my family. The legacy that it as an object connects me to, both in my past and also hopefully, fingers crossed, in the future. And that's kind of where pockets can explode. Because that intimacy has an enormous amount of potential, way disproportionate to their scale. The kind of connections that you make just through the things that you carry with you bleed through everything that you do. And they also show an awful lot about who you are, because you're constantly demonstrating the things that matter to you at the most intimate scale possible. I'm now going to be the fourth person today who references Tom Armitage. Sorry, Tom. A little while back, he was talking about totems. And totems are used in the film Inception to remind the characters in the dream state the physical properties of the real world. For Tom, that's a really great metaphor for exploring that pocket-scale object, because the objects that you carry with you have a symbolic purpose outside of their specific use. The thing that he spoke in, the thing that he used as an example was his Boris bike key. On the one hand, the Boris bike key is a means of accessing a specific part of London's transport network, but it only works within London. He still has it in his pocket when he's over in San Francisco, and it still has a set of meanings associated with it when he's over in San Francisco, because it reminds him of that network, it reminds him of that system, and it reminds him of all of the people that he interacts with when he's in that place. Again, it has a great parallel to the pocket watch. It connects to so many different things while not actually being used for that service. He also illustrated it beautifully. This photograph is of that Boris bike key on his keychain. And it echoes to you so many little facets of Tom. The interesting bit isn't the Boris bike key. It's not the set of keys. It's not even really the robot, it's the combination of all of them. London means home. The robot means something about Tom in the context of home. And together, that transport and that Tomishness bleeds through the object. Tomishness. It's a big reason when you do user testing, you ask people to empty out their pockets because things like this spill out onto the table. You start to learn an awful lot about the person that you're in a room with. And you can start to think about why they're reacting in certain ways to the system that you're talking to them about. All of this complicates the relationship that any one of us has with a big, vast network that's often very difficult to break down and understand. For those of you who might be interested, I've got Lego on my keychain. No other smart objects, I'm afraid. The thing that I do carry around with me a lot, though, is in my back pocket. It's my Oyster card. This is my way of accessing Transport for London. I'm scared of cycling. It's routed to an immovable system still. I can't take London Underground with me. I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to inflict it on Brighton. But unlike the Boris Bike Key, my relationship to this card in particular is starting to change and it's starting to evolve. RFID, I'm sure a lot of you have mucked about with it by now. But for those of you who haven't, RFID is essentially two major components. One is a chip that can be placed inside of almost anything, and one is a reader. The chip, when it moves inside of the space of the reader, wakes up and says, hello, I'm 342. That doesn't really mean anything, except that the reader is attached to a program. And the program associates 342 with a specific person. So it doesn't see 342, it sees Matthew Sherrett, who's just tapped in at Finsbury Park and has £2.50 left. It's only in that relationship that takes place at the system and the network level that the Oyster really has any meaning. But that meaning is as an avatar of me. But RFID doesn't just work with one system, or lots of RFID doesn't really just work with one system. You could put your Oyster card on an awful lot of readers. Hundreds of them will accept that frequency. So you can start plugging the readers into other networks. And that's where it all gets awesome. At Last FM, we started associating Oyster cards with radio stations, which meant that 342 wasn't activating Transport for London, it was activating Joy Division Radio, which was just about the most depressing thing I could think of it triggering, now that I come to say it out loud. But it's still a reflection of me. It's a part of me that's being read by the system and understood, and then has an effect that I start to experience. But it still comes from the intimate object. And that's two services that it attaches to. It's no distance at all from plugging it into things in the home that activate certain things, certain sensors, certain objects. Suddenly this card takes on an awful lot of facets of my personality. And there aren't many other objects or devices that have been able to have that malleability, have that potential. If you think back to the pocket watch, that's an extended set of connections and networks and references and points of imagination. But the Oyster card does that potentially for an awful lot more things. So you multiply those references, you multiply that potential, you multiply those connections. It becomes incredible. Chromaroma is a really lovely example of it. Chromaroma was made by the team up at Mudlark. And it's a game that pulls your Oyster card data into a point scoring mechanic. But the interesting part of it isn't really the game or the mechanic. It's how it feeds your play back to you in the form of these maps that track where you've touched in, where you're exploring, where you're going, where your team are. And you start associating very personal experiences with all of those spaces. So one route that you see crop up an awful lot of times might be your commute, but your commute's becoming something else now. And then you'll see it spinning off in another direction, and that's you going to play Laser Quest somewhere, which is really cool. Suddenly my pocket's reflecting things about me back that I just didn't realise were there. Another really interesting use of RFID, and this is a couple of years old now, so you may have seen it already, is Skoll, which was built by the team at the University of Oslo. And it beautifully articulated that throwaway thing about RFID. The chips can be placed in anything. So that wooden block is a reader, and inside of that doll is a chip. And instead of activating a transport journey, it's activating a Disney film. It's a toy that's generating that, which is super cute. It's too cute for words. And the idea of a home that are filled with these playful tactile objects that can trigger very sensory experiences for anyone willing to pick up and play is incredible. RFID, in that respect, becomes a huge gift for interaction. Things like Skull don't just help us see how malleable it can be. It helps everyone, all of the people in the public, see how malleable these things can be. And we're no distance away from stuff like that bleeding into mass production and hitting stores, or in Matt Webb's words, hitting the Argos catalogue. I'm really excited to see what that world looks like. It means that in no time at all, my Oyster card, one particular kind of chip, isn't just a service avatar but one thing, but it's a totem, a meaningful totem that links me to dozens of facets of my life, dozens of tiny aspects. And small objects like Skull containing these things demonstrate that it's not a huge leap to picture anything holding them. So the Lego on my keychain, or that Lego there, or the little robot on Tom's, could be the means of accessing that system. They could be the smart keychains that enable travel around cities, which becomes way less fictional when you realise that TfL aren't really fussed about card-based transport, and banks aren't really fussed about card-based interactions either now. They want the chips in everything. So therefore, the chips can be in anything. But all at this pocketable scale, because that's the important part of it. You can bundle them into an awful lot of objects, but they all operate at their best in the parameter of the pocket, these permanent things that we have around with us. You could fit a fistful of them in there, but you only really need one. And that one is the one that connects you to so many different things. It's potential ubiquity built right into the size and the scale of it. The same can basically be said of a smartphone. The iPhone, or any smartphone really, is connected to so many networks and so many different things that synchronize time. That big old dial at the top there just feels inconsequential now. I use mine mostly for the utilities, for the camera, the torch, the GPS, the maps, all of that kind of stuff. But all of those really for me are to unlock different stories and different experiences. It's given me hundreds of opportunities to outsource my brain, and I take great delight in doing that. I've no fear about that part of it. But the way that I use it actually only touches on the barest part of its potential. What it's capable of being is something that passively gathers data about that journey in such a way that it can offer those great insights, chromaroma style, into how I live. And at the moment, it doesn't betray that on screen, but what if it did? The iPhone tracker app, it was out in April last year, revealed quite a pretty history of the locations that the phone had visited, all based on a file that saves exactly that data. It's a beautiful example of how that pocket scale object can bounce back at you and reflect experience a lot like chromaroma. Because those dots up in Scotland, I don't view them in the same way that I view those massive dots down in London there. Those dots up in Scotland, and me and my girlfriend stood out looking at the sea, with bellies full of whiskey on a really awesome holiday. I really like that these things can be reflected back at me. I really like that it's the intimate object that's carried around with me at all times that does that. Of course, there are personal security implications to that, but we've been doing this kind of thing for centuries. If you think about cave paintings, this is basically a really, really slow version of Instagram. In which the people who have painted it are showing off who they're with, what they were doing, and what they were about to eat in the fastest means possible at that point in time. It's a record of who they were and what they were doing. And the data travels through time. That's the beautiful part of it. The things that we evidence and the things that our pockets evidence carry for centuries. My only problem with all of this is that the iPhone itself doesn't carry for centuries. The data that it collects might have this lifespan, but it as an object, like Don said earlier, is really supposed to be replaceable every 6 months. If it's designed to be replaced, then that means that the things that are on it are the only things that really say much about me, and they're the only things that I can invest in. That kind of upsets me. Matt Cottam from Telart was looking at heirloom electronics, talking about a technology that's tactile and long-lived. He took the Leica digital camera as an example of one way of seeing heirloom electronics in action. Leica encouraged their M8 users to send their M8s back in to get system and service and hardware upgrades to have the power of the M9. But what remained was the chassis. And the chassis is the thing that collects the patina. It collects the memories and your experience of having this camera sat with you at all times. It's the family axe approach to a device, where any single part of the axe could change, but the heirloom remains. He put it like this at Laptops and Looms a few weeks ago. This isn't mass personalization, like Nike ID, but it's real personalization, like this belonged to my grandfather. I think that's really beautiful, because I'd kill for a smartphone that aged well, and I'd love to imagine services that existed on an aged smartphone, something that had been lived in and had been loved. I don't see this as an heirloom in the way that my grandfather saw his pocket watch, and that feels like a missed opportunity. And it means you guys are never in a position where you can imagine the potential of a serviced on an aged object. It's like Kelly pointed out, how many of you would really miss it if it's gone? There's a moment in the Doctor Who serial, The Visitation, where these aliens crush his sonic screwdriver. The Doctor responds, "I feel as if you've just killed an old friend." And I feel like, as time travellers, we should all care about the objects that we carry with us to that same degree. I'm conscious, actually, that the Doctor Who thing might need explaining to some of you. Americans, I'm sorry. Europeans as well. So for those of you who don't recognise him, this is the current incarnation of the Doctor. The Doctor is the lead character of Doctor Who. He's been the star of TV shows and audio plays, books, the whole shebang, for about 48 years, which is an enormous amount of time. The exterior of the character changes, but there are doctory things that stay the same throughout. Not only that, but on a personal note, it's not the iPhone or the pocket watch or the Oyster card that got me thinking about pockets. It's the Doctor and how he uses his pockets. Because one of the best things, one of the most consistent things about him, is that he's always got something to offer people. There's always something in his pocket that can sort out a situation. That's how he humanizes time travel. Sometimes it'll be jelly babies or wobbly 3D glasses. 9 times out of 10, though, it's the sonic screwdriver. That's the meaningful object. It's the thing that unlocks stories. Now, this was built by this guy, John T. Waring. Hello, John T. He's in the audience. Until recently, John T. was a developer at Last.fm. He's also co-founder of the London Hackspace. Have any of you heard of the London Hackspace? There's one in Brighton. There's Edinburgh Hack Lab, there's North Hackton as well, like a huge community of hacker places. Again, for those of you who haven't heard of the Hack Labs, they're giant urban garden sheds where a bunch of nerds can pool all of their tools into one place and start looking at stuff and saying, how can I break it? And put it back together in strange ways, this being a product of one of them. We took an off-the-shelf sonic screwdriver, stripped out the insides, and made room for the working parts of a laser remote. It behaves exactly, sometimes, like the magic wand that I wanted as a child, and it turns out I still want. Hacking is one of those beautiful ways in which technology that wouldn't otherwise age gets personalized and has that instant meaning. And for me, the most compelling hacks that I've seen are still the pocketable ones. They're the ones that you can just whip out and demonstrate and carry and share. And they scratch itches that contemporary product design haven't quite caught up with yet, which is a beautiful and awesome thing. And they're only going to get easier. There was a... Sorry. As I was saying, hacking is only going to get easier, hopefully better. A couple of weeks ago, Technology Will Save Us announced that they'd be taking over shelf space in Rough Trade Records out in Brick Lane, which means that hacking is going to be put in exactly the same vernacular as vinyl records and baking and vintage and retro. which kind of means that the hipsters are coming for your tools. As far as I'm concerned, that's great. It's going to shed light on it, which is awesome. And it's going to force people to think about the legacy of the objects that they carry with them. And it's going to force people to think about the potential of those objects. Hacks implicitly address the relationship that an object has with a network like TFL or like Twitter or like time. And they place intimacy and personality above all other things, which is exactly what I want in my time travelers. Because I didn't get this sonic screwdriver just to talk about hacking. I got it because the doctor's awesome. Having a screwdriver like this is awesome. He uses pocket scale objects all of the time. This is Patrick Troughton in his incarnation of the Doctor. In one of his biggest stories, Tomb of the Cybermen, pretty much the first thing that he does is whip out a device that he just so happens to have that diffuses in a big electrified door. That's kind of cool. And then more recently, there's in David Tennant's series, a moment where he distracts his guard, this guard, by just whipping out of his pocket a tiny wind-up mouse, which is also kind of cool. But when you start plugging those things together, you start thinking, hang on, wait, in the same coat or in the same pockets, he's carrying a wind-up mouse, he's carrying jelly babies, that weird door thing, he's got the wobbly 3D glasses, he's had dozens of these by now. Who on earth has the space for all of that stuff? At which point it hits me. Of course he's got the space for all of that stuff. He's a Time Lord. Now, the most famous thing about Doctor Who is the TARDIS. There are two things that anyone can tell you about the TARDIS. One is that it's bigger on the inside. Two is that it's a blue box. For the purposes of this, we'll focus on the bigger on the inside bit. Making things bigger on the inside is what Time Lord technology is all about. Of course his pockets are bigger on the inside. They're the Doctor's pockets. So he can just pull anything out of them, all to connect to a bigger story, all to motor through a story that eight-year-olds need to be entertained by and need to be convinced by. It's a metaphor. That's what my pockets do right now. That's what all of yours do right now. They connect us to really big stories. They plug us into time and space and allow us to see things that we otherwise would be completely blind to. Each of the objects that I carry with me connects to incredibly different kinds of network. They say a lot about me and a lot about the person I want to be. If Mike Kuniavsky is right, and we're about to experience a boom in device manufacture, then the devices that matter to us are going to be the ones that we can have a personal connection with and can do very personal things with. I mean, in Kaz's words, I want to have a world filled with objects that are interesting but useless. I want the pretty version of the home to feel like this and a lot less like this, where it might have a lot of uses, but it's just not interesting to me. And I want my time travelers to feel like that as well. I want them to feel like this guy, and I don't want them to feel like these guys. We're building objects for networks that are becoming increasingly fluid, increasingly changeable. But the pocket and the scale of those objects is timeless. And they've connected us to things for centuries. And the things that you put in people's pockets are always going to be next to Lego and keychains and the things that we have around us all the time. My phone, my Oystercard, my sonic screwdriver, my Lego, my pocket watch. These are all things that stay incredibly close to me, that they stay in my pockets at all times, and they connect me to really important things. With my pockets, I get to show off who I am. I get to show off what matters to me. And I think that when you're designing objects that should matter to someone else, and that should be displayed and should be shown to matter to that person, then you need to concentrate on that tiny, tiny scale. Whether it's a service or a device, it will be sat next to Lego, it will be sat next to keychains. And that's really difficult, and it's really challenging, but it's also an awful lot of fun. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy Kevin's talk next. You've been a pleasure.